widespread racism and bewilderment are the seeds of the revolution.
Violence and hatred are the attributes of a sick society.
Who the hell is he?
Peter Norman.
Peter Norman.
Peter Norman. Peter Norman is flying on the outside.
I guess I'd just like to be thought of as an interesting old guy.
There were two Olympic teams. It was the white athletes and the black athletes.
Don't think any of these boys will be foolish enough to demonstrate at the Olympic Games.
Nobody knew what it was going to be.
All I can say is you can expect almost anything.
I was just sick.
For him to take a stance during the Black Revolution from Australia, I thought that was fantastic.
There's this guy from Australia called Peter Norman. Who the hell's he?
A new Olympic record to Peter Norman of Australia.
Peter Norman easily third.
Every time he stepped on the track, he was running better.
This is the hottest 200-meter field ever assembled.
Peter Norman is an enigma to me because he came from nowhere.
This was life and death.
They say that you're not in the team.
I believe in human rights. No way somebody I never heard of from Australia was going to split them up.
I'm sick to death hearing your anthem.
It's a pleasure for me to know Peter, and it's a pleasure for my people to know Peter now.
So this past month has marked the 50th anniversary of one of the most iconic moments in sports history when John Carlos and Tommy Smith bowed their heads and joined in a Black Power salute while on the podium at the 1968 Mexico Olympics. Both Carlos and Smith rightly lauded for the stand they took for human rights. But what of the other man on the podium? Australia's Peter Norman won the silver medal in that 200 metres race behind Tommy Smith and ahead of John Carlos. He wore a badge on the podium in support of the Olympic Project for Human Rights, and the reaction he received in his home country over the past five decades was very different to what Smith and Carlos have received. Peter Norman's story is the focus of a new book, The Peter Norman Story. It's co-authored by Andrew Webster and Matt Norman, who is Peter Norman's nephew, and Matt Norman joins us now on the line from Australia. Evening as it is for you, Matt.
Yes, good evening. Thanks for having me.
Your uncle's story, it is fascinating and quite a tragic story in many ways. Before we get into what happened after he received his silver medal and stood on that podium, can you tell us about Peter Norman's life before the 68 Olympics?
Yeah, so Peter was obviously a really keen sportsman, but he started quite early, at about the age of 14 years old, when he was going to a little athletics club, and he tried to get in on high jump, which is something that his cousin really wanted to do, and he didn't do very well at that. And then they were short for a relay team, and they asked Peter if he'd be interested in having a shot at the relay, and all he had to do was hold on to the baton and the last leg and get to the end, and he ended up winning it for them. So from that day on, he became a sprinter, and ever since that was his newfound fame.
He won the silver medal at the 68 Olympics in the 200 metres. Was there an expectation going to Mexico City that he would medal?
No, and that's the whole thing. Peter was quite small for a sprinter. I mean, he was around 5'10", compared to Tommy and John, which were, 6'4". It was a big man's sport, so to speak, and so Peter was known as the little white guy. So he wasn't necessarily expecting a medal at that stage, and the fact that he had never sprinted on what they called the tartan tracks, he was always sprinting on grass tracks here in Australia. So he never knew what it was going to be like until he got there, and then he realised that once he started on tartan tracks, he was actually, his stride was lengthening by quite some time. So his times between Australia and Mexico were quite remarkable.
Yeah, and his times in Mexico were quite unbelievable as well. Won his heat in a time of 20.17 seconds, which for a little while was an Olympic record. finishes second in the final in a time of 20.06, which still 50 years on is an Australian record.
Yeah, it's that's what's most incredible about this story is that we're now 50 years past and Peter's record still stands here in Australia. So no one's been able to come close to actually breaking that.
So Tommy Smith won the race, the 200 metres final, world record time, 19.83 seconds. Peter Norman finishes in second, just passing John Carlos as they're heading towards the finish line. What happens next after the race? When does Peter Norman become aware of what Smith and Carlos are planning on doing on the podium?
Yeah, so what happens is that they all three gentlemen go down underneath the stadium and they're put into the winner's room. And it was only at that stage that Tommy and John started discussing what they were going to do to protest about the black rights. And that's when everything started to take shape. So Tommy and John decided to put their black glove fists in the air. Unfortunately, John Carlos left his gloves at home. And so it was Peter that actually said, you know, you're only going to be holding up one hand.
Right.
So why don't you share the gloves? And so Peter, after listening to what they were going to do, said, look, I really want to be able to support you and I believe in human rights. And so he said, can I wear one of those badges? And they were both wearing a Olympic Project for Human Rights badge. So he ended up getting one as they were walking out to the dais.
Peter Norman, I guess, was coming from a very different way of life in Australia. Was he very aware of the civil rights movement in America and what Smith and Carlos were standing for?
Yeah, absolutely. And look, it was very well known that there were the issues going on in America during that year in 1968. Martin Luther King had been assassinated and Robert Kennedy was also assassinated just months prior to the Olympic Games. We had our own severe racial problems with the White Australia policy here in Australia. And so he was very much aware of the civil human rights issues that were going on in our own country. And so knowing that these sort of issues were also part of the American culture going into the Olympics. He did know that, you know, there was a possible boycott of all black nations going into the Olympics as well. So he knew that there was issues going on and, you know, didn't know that he was going to be a big part of it.
Mm. Still, as with all these cases, the easy option would have been to do nothing, particularly when he's just fulfilled, I guess, his lifetime ambition. He's just won an Olympic silver medal. A lot of people would just want to get out there onto the podium, receive their silver medal, take the accolades, keep their head down and let the other two make their protest, but just keep quiet. What was it that was in him that he didn't want to take that he wanted to take a stand with them?
I think the main thing is he grew up in a Salvation Army background all his life. And back here in Australia, the Salvos or the Salvation Army, they, you know, if you think about different religions and different church groups and things like that, the Salvation Army was a very hands-on type of religion where he would go out at night with his parents and give blankets to the homeless and food to the homeless and things like that. So it was a very hands-on type of religion, more than just going to church and that's all you did. So Peter had that sort of ingrained in him growing up that you stand up for injustice and you look after the people that need looking after. So I think that was the big difference. A lot of people said that, you know, if there was an American, Larry Quested, who could have been that person that came second or third or whatever, that the thing would have been a lot different if an American white guy was there. But Peter believed in human rights and knew that this was something that he could stand for.
Mm. So he was wearing at this badge an Olympic Project for Human Rights, which I think he had taken from a member of the US rowing team on his way to the podium and asked him, could he wear it? Still, it is just a badge. So when you look at the pictures, you really need to look up close to see that he is taking part, taking his own unique part in this protest. When did it become aware to people around Peter Norman that he had stood side by side with Carlos and with Smith and was very much part of this protest?
Yeah, I mean, one of the big things, if we look at protests today compared to the 1960s, one of the things that you need to look at is the perspective, and that is that, you know, people were being assassinated because they were standing up for black rights back in those days. So for him to just wear a badge was a huge thing to do at that sort of stage. It was known straight away that Tommy and John got banned from the Olympics within 2 days of that protest. And Peter was brought into the AOC's, the Australian Olympic Committee's chief, Judy Patching at the time. And they said, obviously, Tommy and John have been sent home from Mexico, and obviously we need to reprimand you. So consider yourself severely reprimanded, and here's two tickets to the hockey. So that's as far as it went in 68. But it was much later on in 1972 when Peter found out that, you know, what he had done in 68 was causing a lot of rift here in Australia, where he wasn't selected to go to the Munich Games, even though he was number five in the world, had a silver medal in the 68 Games, and qualified for those 72 games 15 times for the 100 and 200, and yet wasn't selected.
So it seems initially then, actually, that the response from the Australian Olympic Committee was quite reasonable. Was it only when he returned to Australia and they saw the public reaction that it started to turn against Peter Norman?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's where the story of Peter's life sort of took its toll, is that, you know, a white guy in Australia standing up for black rights just wasn't the cool time to be doing that. And so he got called a lot of names, and the establishment sort of turned on him. And although he still didn't suffer that much, it was only later when he tried to progress as an Olympian that he really started to suffer. But a lot of the, you know, back in Australia in those days, we had a very racist country, and it was known for, you know, you just don't stand up for black rights, full stop. So, yeah, he put up with a lot.
And was there a sense in those intervening 4 years then, from 68 to trying to get back on the team for 72, that he was being somewhat ostracised within the Olympic movement?
Yeah, and, you know, he always considered that, you know, one of the things that had always come up is that that he wasn't being ostracised, and that it was just because he had a bad day when it came to the trials. But at the end of the day, you know, they took long-distance runners who had done bad days on trial day purely based on their previous performance. So he knew that there was a reason behind the fact that he wasn't going to Munich. And the times that he was running, he would have won gold as well, because one of the biggest competitors at Munich would have been Tommy and John, and they were obviously banned. So that sort of took them out completely.
And had he any backers, any public backers during that period, people who came out publicly and said, actually, we're proud of this Australian, he has done the right thing?
No, and that's the seriousness of it, is that it's only recently in the last, say, two decades, and especially in the last 10 years, that people here in Australia have even known that Peter Norman was the silver medalist in 68. And that's taken, you know, my film Salute, which came out 10 years ago, for people to go, an Australian was actually a silver medalist at the Mexico's at the Olympics. That's the crazy thing that I've found over all of this time, is that most people don't even know that an Aussie actually got to a 200-metre final. And it's quite scary to me that after 50 years, we've got the fastest Australian in history, and he's just unknown here.
Yeah, I have to say, in preparing for this interview, I listened back to some other interviews that you've been doing over the last few months surrounding the publication of the book, and I found it incredibly striking that pretty much every Australian radio station or whatever publication it was that you spoke to didn't seem to know the story of Peter Norman. That, as you say, with the record still lasting to this day, 50 years on, he's still the fastest Australian over 200 metres with the stand that he took, that it has been completely ignored and a sort of missing piece of Australian, certainly sporting history, and just Australian history in general.
Yeah, that's right. And I have to say that in the last 12 months, things have obviously changed. And I've spent the last 16 years on this story and with the film Salute, which did really well and which is now still playing in cinemas around the world. Like in Italy, it came out last week, even after 10 years. And the book, obviously. But this year alone, Peter won the Order of Merit for not only being a great Olympian, but also human rights activist, which is given out rarely to great athletes. Also, we've finally named October 9, which is the day in America they call Peter Norman Day. In Australia, it's going to be now known as Peter Norman Day, which is the day of his funeral. And also a statue's to be made in his honour next year. So apart from that, my last journey on this 16-year ride is that Hollywood have come knocking and we're now doing a Hollywood feature film in the next year. So that's all being signed up now. So hopefully what that'll do is it'll put his name back in history worldwide. In America, he's very well known, but in Australia and other countries, still not, unfortunately. So hopefully this feature film that will go worldwide will put his name back in history.
We should point out, of course, that all this recognition that has come in recent years is coming posthumously for Peter Norman. He died of a heart attack October 2006 at a very young age. He was only 64. And looking at the book and how he dealt with the public reaction and what he had to go through after the 72 Olympics and missing out in that in particular, in the book, you talk about how his personal life pretty much disintegrates. Certain people say that there's two Peter Normans. At one stage, he loses touch with his children. Is it too simplistic to lay the blame for the way his personal life disintegrates at the door of the reaction he received?
Look, I think one of the worst things that actually happened to him is he's not far past 72 is that he got an Achilles tendon injury and that actually caused him to get gangrene on his legs and they were going to amputate both legs and instead what they did was they ended up opening his legs up and then keeping them open, the flesh open for a few months and then they ended up sewing his legs together so that the blood flow would continue going through. So he went through a lot of issues with painkillers and then alcohol, and that was kind of his demise for the next, decade or two and, lost touch with his kids and so, had depression and things like that. So the unfortunate thing was that in, when he died, he was starting to be recognised and obviously the film that I was doing, it was just before the film was released that he died and the whole idea was to actually showcase Peter and for him to actually celebrate the fact that people did know who he was. And unfortunately, he died before that ever happened.
Tommy Smith and John Carlos are both still alive and rightly have become the legendary figures that they deserve to be and have been recognised time and time again in recent years. And it seems they've done a huge amount as well to keep Peter Norman's name alive. And I didn't realise that there were pallbearers at his funeral.
Yeah, that's the special part of this story, is that Tommy and John were certainly like brothers to Peter all his life. And Tommy and John don't necessarily get along too well together, but Peter used to always go over to the US every time they were being honoured or being given an award or a statue or whatnot. And Peter would always be involved in that. And, I ended up inviting Tommy and John, the most important people, I think, to Peter's life was the friendship he had with Tommy and John. And so when Peter died, they were the first people I actually called and let them know that the funeral was on and they were quick to jump on a plane and actually come over as pallbearers to Peter's funeral. But one of the things that most people don't understand is that they were very much like brothers throughout their entire lives together and that friendship still remains today, especially, the likes of John Carlos, who literally reminds the world every time he's interviewed about Peter Norman. So there was a very special connection.
that connection, was that developed in that 3-4 year period after 68, when there were all three of them been totally ostracized and when they were facing not going to the Munich Olympics in 72? Was that something that bond, was it something that came about very quickly?
Yeah, I think it was, because Tommy and John knew that they had no more Olympic career, but they thought that Peter would actually continue on down the path. But unfortunately, that didn't happen for Peter either. So they realised that while they stayed in America and they had each other to handle all the criticism and all that sort of thing, Peter was by himself all the way over in Australia. So I think the bond grew from that point, and it just never stopped from that point onwards.
You mentioned that an awful lot of recognition was given to both of them in America and to Peter Norman as well, where US Track and Field Association created Peter Norman Day in recognition of his actions long before anything happened in Australia. And one of the parts of this story that's particularly upsetting is around the Olympics in Sydney in 2000. What happened there, and why wasn't he recognised?
Yeah, that's been the most disappointing for me, especially as his nephew, is that you know, on the day of the Olympics here in Sydney, he was actually the MC at my wedding. And I asked him the question, why aren't you at the Olympics doing a lap of honour like the rest of the Australian top echelon of athletics? And he said, because I just wasn't invited. So he wasn't invited in any official capacity to take part in those Olympics, even though he's our number one sprinter of all time. And so that was a real shock to me and to a lot of people, that he just didn't go. And he ended up, the American team ended up finding out that he wasn't there and realising that he wasn't there because he just wasn't invited. So they ended up inviting him through the American team. And so he literally went to our own Olympic Games with the American team.
The Australian Olympic Committee's role for many years throughout this, it's pretty disgraceful, it seems, particularly when you look at 2012 and there's an Australian Parliament apology where they recognise the extraordinary athletic achievements of Peter Norman, they acknowledge his bravery in taking the stand in 1968, and they also apologise for the treatment he received upon his return to Australia, and eventually recognised the powerful role that he played in furthering racial equality. It was a very strong statement from the Australian Parliament. But yet again after that, the Australian Olympic Committee dispute some of the claims. You would think at that stage, he's in his grave, you just let it rest.
Yeah, that's been the hard thing to handle. And that is, you know, I get in the press with all these things that have come up through the documentary that, you know, not only Peter said, but also the Australian coach and Peter's coach and even the one of the AOC presidents at the time said that Peter should have been in Munich, and yet today we're still arguing whether or not he should have gone or not. And the facts of the matter are quite simple, and that is that he qualified 15 times that year for the 100 and 200 metres. He was ranked number 5 in the world and had a silver medal at the last Olympics and still wasn't taken to Munich. And the problem that I've always had is that they, for some reason, the AOC don't look back at history and just want to make sure that that they look right. And unfortunately, they were wrong in doing that. So it seems to be just an ongoing battle that they're not willing to say too much more about it. But I should say that Athletics Australia are the ones that are behind Peter Norman Day now, and also the ones that are putting the statue. So I've got that funny feeling that it's actually got through to them, and I think this is the way that they're using to maybe pass some wrongs.
Yeah, and as you say, over the last couple of years, there has been a change and a bit more recognition at long last for what Peter Norman did on that day at the Mexico Olympics. It's been great talking to you, Matt. The Hollywood movie sounds pretty exciting.
Yeah, it's actually going to be bigger than I ever thought. So we were contacted, I've been working on that for some time, but we were contacted just over a week ago to say that we're that the studio system are going to fully finance and get it done properly. So,
do you know who's going to play Peter Norman?
Well, I've put out in the media that I'd love Chris Hemsworth to play Peter Norman because they do have very similar looks. Chris is obviously a little bit too tall, but I'm sure with Hollywood magic we can do something about chopping his legs down or something.
Matt, brilliant to talk to you. Thanks a lot for taking the call. It is a fascinating story and well done for keeping the legacy of Peter Norman alive.
Thanks, Martin. It's great to talk to you.
Off the Ball.
Find us on Twitter at Off the Ball.
News Talk 106 to 108.